Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
He asked me, what's your out pitch? And I said, it's my slider. And he said, we could throw that. But he's a great low ball side-to-side hitter. He really struggles with depth and a speed change. If your curveball is good enough, put it on the plate. We'll strike him out.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's interview series from Phenom to the Farm, where we're talking to former professional baseball players to reminisce about their playing days and what they learned on their journey from amateur ball to the professional ranks. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, we are joined by Barry Enright, former big league right-hander and currently a pitching coach in the D-back system. We talk about Barry's extremely successful college career at Pepperdine, West Coast baseball and pitching in an NCAA regional against Troy Tulowitzki and Evan Longoria, and how important combining command and confidence are, and the experience of transitioning his career full-time over to the Mexican League. We also talk some golf. If you follow Barry on social media, you know that Barry is very, very good at golf, so safe to say this will likely be the only episode of this podcast that features a good Kevin Na story. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, please do leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA Podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. College baseball season is officially a go. Joe Healy and Teddy Cahill are providing tons of good weekly content. Weekly pods of the new pod Future Projection from Ben Badler and Carlos Collazo is great. I highly encourage everyone to go check that out. So as always, it is always a good time to be subscribed to BaseballAmericas.com. Also, if you are a sports movie or sports documentary fan, my other podcast, Big Screen Sports, me and Baseball America's JJ Cooper just released an episode yesterday talking about the incredible sports documentary Senna. That is worth a watch if you have not seen it. So if you have, go check out that episode. For future guest info of this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Bandujo. But for now, let's talk to Barry Enright. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm, he was a second-round pick of the D-backs in 2007 out of Pepperdine, former big league pitcher and champion of the 2020 TPC Champions Classic on the Outlaw Golf Tour, Barry Enright. Barry, thanks so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate being here.
Of course. You are the you're the first person who's appeared on this podcast series who has won a golf tournament, a professional golf tournament. You've both pitched in the big leagues and won a professional golf tournament. Right off the bat, what felt better, the golf win or your big league debut?
I would definitely have to still say the big league debut. You know, that was something that was a long time coming. Baseball, obviously, golf always had the kind of the backseat. Baseball was always kind of flourished there, and so kind of getting that call through my pitching coach, which is now my boss now, Dan Carlson, getting the call from him and being able to obviously head out to St. Louis Stadium was pretty cool.
So growing up in California, how did you balance baseball and golf and playing quarterback as well, a position that requires a lot of focus? When you got into high school, how did you juggle three sports, especially when football takes up it takes a ton of time to be a quarterback?
You know, it was actually tough at times, as you can imagine. I mean, I did it kind of all through my childhood. As a father now, it actually makes me respect my parents that much more of the time that they took to be able to do it with me. But quarterback, I think, looking back, quarterback, baseball, golf, even actually a little basketball, kind of all flowed into one another. I think that every sport kind of ended up making me a better athlete in the next one. And it's a big component that I kind of talk to kids and parents nowadays is being able to continue that athletic ability through all sports. But there was a time myself after my sophomore year, which I played sophomore and varsity football, and I was going into my junior season and kind of was getting a little attention for baseball and thought, why do I need football? And I kind of focused on baseball through that whole summer. And ironically, that first preseason game came around for football. We lost to, I believe it was Jesuit. And I was actually in tears and kind of missed football so much, along with was so bored of baseball at that time. And just kind of realized that being competitive in a different sport, being able to kind of transition, I wasn't ready to just be a one sport athlete. Baseball was, like I said, it kind of got me burnt out. And I think you can start to narrow that down and focus when you're a little bit older. But through that high school setting, I think it was better for me, even though it seems more hectic. It was better for me to actually play multiple sports, and how each and every like kind of mental challenge to physicality in each sport or agility work kind of blended, like I said, into the next. Just made me a better athlete and better. Player in that each sport I played.
So how did you get around to narrowing and deciding on baseball when it came time to pick what you were doing at the next level? Because you clearly, I mean, you played quarterback, you clearly have golf talent. What makes baseball the play? Were you thinking like in the future, like I am the best at this, so it, you know, and it's my chance to have the best, or is it the thing you love the most? Kind of how do you, when it gets down to brass tacks, how do you make that decision?
I was fortunate enough to have a little, obviously a few scholarships for football as well. Golf, I had a golf coach actually before going into high school from the University of Pacific in Stockton where I grew up, kind of could try to convince me to quit baseball and focus on golf. I think it goes back to my dad played baseball and football actually at Santa Clara when they had a football team, but baseball was his main sport. He was my coach through baseball, kind of growing up until he passed when I was 13. He was the first one to kind of like instill that love and putting that baseball in my hand. And I just think I kind of took to it a lot. Going through Little League, we had a team that went 80-0 through our 4 years. And you look back and you see how the dads and parents probably stacked that team probably illegally at some point to make that happen. But just kind of breeding that winning mentality, like we were actually even talking about earlier, is I think just made me fall in love with it. Being on that mound, even though I played shortstop and all that kind of stuff through high school as well and through Little League, but being on that mound and being the person that kind of controlled everything was even different than football for me. You know, there was like a defensive side and an offensive side to football. I played a little defense too, but it was like going over to baseball, nothing started until that ball in my hand, like, you know, kind of went towards the batter. And so I think that adrenaline rush to feeling like in command of all things probably drew me even closer to that. And then eventually it just got a decent amount of attention for it through high school and paved a way to obviously get me to college.
Well, normally on the show, I ask, you know, why did you settle on the school you went to? You know, how did you, and you ended up at Pepperdine. I actually want to know, how do coaches recruit against Pepperdine? Like, how do you talk someone out of going to Malibu? How does another school's coach say, you see this nice campus, I need you to not go there?
That's exactly how my mom actually got trapped in. And I don't even think it was my decision at that point. She walked up to the cafeteria, looked out the big glass windows over to the ocean and said, Barry, you're going here. that coupled in with a great education. She said, yeah, I don't think you have any say in this anymore. Joking, but I don't actually think she was joking. I originally wanted to go to Stanford, to be honest. It was up from a NorCal standpoint. I didn't even know what Pepperdine was. When they called me the first day, they called me and said, Pepperdine University, we want to offer you a scholarship, such and such. And I said, thank you very much. And I hung up the phone, remember like, okay, ASU called, Cal called, Stanford called. Those are guys. And Pepperdine was in the backseat. Until they kind of kept calling. I met them through like area code games and things like that. And of course, then you step foot on campus and it's like, wow, I get to play here. You know, I get to play at the Pacific Ocean. It was drastically different from coming from Stockton. Stockton now is a little bit more rough. It was nicer when I was kind of growing up, but it's a little rougher. And so going from Stockton to Malibu was quite the contrast. And so Stanford, I didn't end up getting a scholarship there. They told me I didn't have enough AP classes, which I see now they just wanted somebody else.
What a standard thing to say.
Yeah. And I think that, it was just kind of God's work that got me over to Pepperdine. Steve Rodriguez was awesome. Coach Sean Kenny was my pitching coach, who I took to very early. Steve Rodriguez is now someone that is still in my life. And just developing those relationships with those people, going to Pepperdine. I was never also kind of through high school, never a big party kid, went to a small Catholic high school. So kind of blending that into Pepperdine, not being a huge, maybe ASU campus of 70,000 kids, probably really helped me to focus on school and baseball.
You get to campus, and for most guys who get to college ball, there's an adjustment period, but how much, at least in the recruiting process, did they prep you to be, to say, hey, you're going to be a part of a, you know, you're going to be a big part of our squad in your freshman year. And then, like, how soon were you comfortable at the level? Because you contributed right away to the point where you're the West Coast Conference, you know, freshman of the year.
I think we actually had a pretty strong recruiting class. If I remember that year, I think we might've been even number two in the country. And, a lot of guys that I played with, Jason Dominguez, Adam Oberhowski, guys that I played with in Errico games, some big arms. I think when they had talked to me, you know, I actually came in as a two-way player. They took hitting away from me as my first start. I gave up like three or four runs in the first three innings. But they had given me an opportunity to come in and say, hey, you have a chance to compete here for a weekend spot, which might not have happened if I would have went to maybe a big Pac-10, obviously Pac-12 school now, or someone that was a little bit bigger. They said, hey, this is your spot if you want to compete and win it. And that was always kind of the best thing that I believed I had, was just obviously being competitive. And then in college, it really helps to have command. I wasn't always the hardest thrower. I wasn't always the best stuff guy. I think that probably nowadays, looking back with the tools we have now, would have been a little bit better in those departments. But in college, it's all about command and exposing that strike zone, which we know is a little bit bigger than when you get into minor league and big league baseball. And so
just a little bit.
Yeah, I remember going maybe 3-4 inches off the plate for strike one. The next one, it was 8 inches off the plate. The next one's a foot off the plate. As long as you hit the catcher in the middle, you know, the middle of their body, was strike three. I was able to kind of do that through my dad did a lot of things with me. You can see it now as like variable training or different targets. Everything was kind of centered back into just having feel and command, whether it's throwing a football, shooting a basketball, hitting a golf ball, developing feel at such a young age that I think it really helped me through my command through those years. And like I said, I think command is king, especially in college baseball.
Jumping all the way ahead to what you're doing now, your most recent baseball job and coaching in short season. If you had signed out of high school that first year you were at Pepperdine, instead you would have probably been in rookie ball, like in Hillsboro or maybe in low A if they had thought you that advanced. What did you get out of that first year at Pepperdine on the field and off that you might not have been able to get or might not have been ready for if you had jumped straight into pro ball?
Honestly, I think it's the discipline, the time management. I think obviously you face great competition. We had a great out-of-conference schedule as well, where we faced, you know, the USCs and the Long Beaches and the Cal State Fullertons and such and such. And, you know, we even had good teams in our conference at the time with San Diego, and you end up having, you know, Brian Mash, Josh Romanski, guys through there, Aaron Pareda and Scott Cousins at USF. We had some talented teams we faced there as well, but going back to like just stepping foot on campus, we had 5:30 in the morning practices all fall. You know, Tuesday, Thursday was running. Monday, Wednesday, Friday was lifting. You had on-field stuff in groups after class. You know, I went from 5:30 in the morning workout to 8 a.m. class. You're exhausted. You learn a work ethic. You learn time management. You learn how to get – I think I was a 3.9 student through high school with like a 1250 SAT. And I think my first semester at Pepperdine, I got like a 2.4. And it was because I literally would fall asleep in class at the beginning. Didn't know, like we got in trouble if we were under 2.5. Everyone got thrown to study hall. I think our entire recruiting class were all talented baseball players that ended up having to be thrown in study hall because we needed a little jolt in that area. But I think that was the biggest adjustment for me, is learning how to manage your time and learning actually what hard work is, and no cutting any corners if you want to be good and if you want to be diligent and good in the classroom as well. And so I think going that into minor league baseball, and if you first off don't have that cultural aspect, I think every year that you get older and experience new things, travel to different places, travel on planes to play different teams, pitching in Houston in front of a crowd that I remember as a freshman that they can drink. You know, it wasn't a dry campus like Pepperdine, and people are hooting and hollering at you and calling your names. And it was like, man, this is crazy. And being able to get all of that and those experiences and draw from that and kind of end up enjoying those things and those challenges, I think if you just kind of get put out on your own as an 18-year-old, it could be very, very challenging if you don't have the right people with the right family in your corner that a team kind of provides at college.
This series is much more about players like you giving advice to people coming up in your shoes, but I would just like to interject and give some advice to anyone who hasn't gotten into college yet who might be listening. Never take an 8 a.m. class. It's just not worth it. Unless you absolutely have to, it's just not worth it.
With you on that. I think I didn't even have time to cut my hair. I think it was the only time actually my hair grew out past my nose, and I looked like a little redheaded surfer boy down in SoCal because I was exhausted. And so 8 a.m. class, you're right. I think I every baseball season, that was usually during, that was the fall, obviously, when we came in, but every baseball season, that 8 a.m. class, I would always drop it. And so that's why I had a few more credits to finish up once I left Pepperdine my junior year.
Yeah, I did an 8 a.m. fall of my freshman year, and then never again. I never took a class earlier than 11 o'clock in the morning.
Smart guy.
You mentioned that tough non-conference schedule. You get into regionals, and the game you're starting is against one of those tough non-conference teams. It is against Long Beach State. What did the scouting report look like before those games, particularly around those two dudes?
The craziest part about it, I didn't actually remember, because Tulo was so good, Troy Tulowitzki, I don't remember Longoria being much of a force my freshman year until my sophomore year when he was a junior. He didn't get as much clout as like the Tulowitzki did, and Tulo was so good. The best part of that game, you know, you're nervous as a freshman, but I just kind of loved once you that adrenaline or that nervousness turned into adrenaline, and it just locks you in, and it's always – I always felt actually I thrived in those situations, you know, from a young age, because I was never the hardest thrower. A lot of times in high school, scouts came to see somebody else, and it was always those games that you end up kind of making a name for yourself because they're there, not to see you, but someone else. And going into that freshman year, there was like, man, I get to face Troy Tulowitzki. This guy's going to be drafted top five. This guy's, you know, getting all the talk, and you're kind of the underdog. The best part actually about that game is he came up. I think we were winning 3-0 at the time. He came up first and third and two outs. And back when they had the best move possible, the 31 move, you know, third to first pickoff move, I did one of those and picked the guy off at first while he was still looking into the home plate. And with Tulowitzki sitting there with two outs, and obviously get out of the inning, go back out the next inning, have to face him with no one on, hang a curveball, and he hits a 400-foot bomb to left for a solo shot, not a three-run homer. So we only went to 3-1. And it's kind of like it changed the whole aspect of, I remember just kind of coming off there with a huge sigh of relief, like, thank goodness this guy at first base was this dumb to not be just standing on first base and let Tulo just hit no matter what. And it turned into a solo homer, not a three-run homer, and we ended up winning the game. And sadly, at Pepperdine, we never made it to a super regional. We always lost that regional championship game that year as USC, but that was a pretty good regional plan.
So I kind of want to talk NCAA regionals in general, because you played in three during your time at Pepperdine. You've been a team traveling. You were at Long Beach twice. You've also been a host. Are there any pros and cons to being the host team, not being the host team? Did you have a preference?
We were pretty darn good my sophomore year, and to host that regional, I think what made it tough to host regional at Pepperdine is actually not having lights and not being able to play night games and playing kind of everything in the afternoon and not drawing a huge crowd. So if we were a college team, you know, maybe a Vanderbilt, maybe – even in Houston, I remember drawing huge crowds when I was there. East Carolina was a tough place to play at. They had the jungle in left field that they knew everything about you. You'd get 50 people requesting you on Facebook that week to try to find every dirt possible that they can wear you out. it was amazing. You'd delete them all, they'd be back up the next day. And so I think if we would have had that type of home field advantage, that would have been such a great experience. Like I said, we won the Friday game when I threw against Scherzer, Missouri. We won the Saturday game when Paul Coleman for us beat David Huff against UCLA. And then Aaron Crow came back. He's a freshman at Missouri and beat us 3-0 through 9-inning shutty against us on Sunday. And then we lost on Monday as well. I think I gave 1-4. And we ended up losing 2-0. And we were the first team to ever let a 4-seed get out. And I think the next year, Fresno State or something won the whole thing as a 4-seed in a regional. And so we paved the way for them, we like to say. But
yeah, Fresno got hot.
Yeah. And so I think that I would have loved to host a regional with a little bit more electric atmosphere. And I think the lights thing at Pepperdine has been a huge discussion all the time with residents that kind of live on the side and on campus that haven't want those lights be shining in their backyard and things like that. And they're still working on it. Could I keep in touch with them a good amount? Now that Danny Worth, who was my shortstop at Pepperdine, is a hitting coach for them, and Rick Hurtensteiner, who is our third base coach, is now the manager. And I think that would have made it a lot better. I think it's tough to go travel for regional. Traveling to Long Beach for us isn't too tough, but there was always tough teams in there. Long Beach is always a tough team. We had USC, I think Rhode Island was actually a decent 4-seed 1 year, and then we lost UCLA my junior year when UCLA was actually pretty good. And so those West Coast teams kind of beating up on each other, it always seems like it ends up happening. And they stay out.
Yeah, that's kind of the big criticism of the NCAA tournament format right now, is that it makes it very hard for multiple West Coast teams to make it to the College World Series because they're all stuck regionally, just all killing each other.
Definitely. And I always had this argument with, I don't know if you remember the name, Ed Easley, Mississippi State catcher, who was a Diamondback. He actually got drafted, I think, the pick before me in the supplemental round with us. And we're good friends. And he always wore me out like, oh, another SEC team won the College World Series. And I always made this argument, you guys got this easy path, and joking with them. But now, other than Oregon State those years, maybe Fresno State, it seems like that beat up on each other and those West Coast teams kind of fizzle out.
Mm-hmm. So after that freshman year, you're coming off being the West Coast Conference freshman of the year, you're coming off beating Troy Tulowitzki and Long Beach State. What's the exit meeting like? What's the game plan to build on that and not get kind of complacent? Where did you need to grow and how did you improve both in your sophomore and junior year?
I think it was, even through the coaching staff, challenging myself and others in my class to take more of that leadership role. You come in, you're kind of starry-eyed a little bit of guys that are a little bit older than you. You're learning from them. Sometimes it's better to listen than to talk, I believe, and absorb that in. There's obviously always that back in the day when you're allowed to kind of haze people and such. Wasn't bad for me. I think they made me drink clam juice because I never drank alcohol. Some along very easy hazing, but you develop relationships with these older guys that, were end up being your leaders and you learn from them. And I think going into that next year for me was stepping up as a leader, expecting it. Now you got actual expectations kind of on your shoulder, not only to be good individually, but kind of to lead a team. And we had other guys there as well. Danny Worth, who had a good freshman year, Chad Tracy, who was a great sophomore campaign going into being a junior. And, from Jason Dominguez, Adam Oberhaus, you guys that had big arms that, were expected to help as well. I think it was now you're teaching, the freshman class coming. We had Brett Hunter, who had a big, big arm, that year and, ended up being one of our starters. He came in, and I remember my coach would always make me house all the recruits that kind of came. I would always have to be the people that took them out to dinner or had them over and just kind of showing that trust in me to then develop that leadership and those relationships with those guys to kind of push the team forward and create a culture in that team. And not just kind of be an individual thing, more so like lead the team aspect into the following year.
Well, your sophomore year, the West Coast Conference Pitcher of the Year, junior year, you're a Golden Spike semifinalist. Like, things on the field are going well. Naturally, like, when did you start turning your attention to what your pro prospects look like? When did you start hearing from clubs? And what's the run up to draft day like for a college junior?
You know, I would going back through that process, I don't think I ever let it really absorb me. I mean, it was great to get attention. But what I really, really enjoyed about college baseball, in contrast to minor league baseball, obviously, is the aspect of winning. Like, the winning and how the culture, you know, was built off of that. And going back to, like, caring about every single game. And so being so, you know, absorbed in that aspect, I think it was really hard to kind of just think about where I'm going to be drafted and all these things until that finished. And so that was a good thing, I think, which, you know, didn't allow me to be kind of distracted going into junior year. Didn't allow me to, you know, feel pressure in that aspect. I do remember a scout for the Cincinnati Reds kind of cornering me one time and saying, "Are you the best pitcher on your team?" And I said, "You know, I think that's for you to determine." And he said it again to me, and I said, "Well, you know, I don't really want to talk about myself." And he said, "If you can't tell me you're the best pitcher on your team, we'll never draft you." And kind of like made it a really, really tough conversation for me. And I think that was the first time where I didn't totally enjoy those conversations, but I always obviously gave them the time because I knew they were important, but I always wanted to do it just to get back into the team aspect. I really enjoyed that part of it. And that was probably the biggest difference in going into pro ball, was not everyone caring in that same direction. And it being a little bit more about development at times than actually winning. And that was hard for me. But back to the college, I think that's what helped me during that year, is I didn't really have to focus on what was happening draft-wise. I just had to focus on what was in front of me.
Well, the D-backs pop you in the second round after your junior year. You signed fairly quickly. And then, so per Baseball America's draft report, scouts like your frame, they like your track record. Most of all, they like your competitiveness, which kind of, you know, speaks to what you were just talking about with liking the winning and stuff. They thought it gave you more upside than your present stuff, your stuff at the time, might have suggested. What was your scouting report on yourself when you signed?
You know, I think I fed into it a little bit too much. I to be honest, going back of being that vanilla, I am who I am. I remember a scout telling me one time, I think it was from the Cubs, said if you had basically Adam's arm, Obrachowski at the time, because he was up to 95 or 96, but didn't really have the command and didn't really have like kind of the mentality side of it. I think he ended up being drafted in the fifth round. If you had his arm, you'd be the first overall pick. And from makeup to command to all the stuff that kind of went to it. I think that's where college hurt a little bit, was where I think college is so much better now. Obviously, implementation of the data with TrackMan, Repsoto, and all the edutronic stuff and pitch design, and how I would make maybe my slider better, how I would care about, you know, my horizontal break or, you know, or vertical break of a slider or my curveball. How I would try to get a little bit more or how I would use out of my fastball. I think I got into that, put myself into a box of being very robotic mechanically, just to almost turn into a dart thrower at times, and not from programs I have now to obviously weighted ball treatments to how we move down the mound and different variable training aspects. I think velocity training can be trained for guys that at least have the ability to do so. And I think all of those things probably would have got me out of my comfort zone. That would have actually made me my stuff a lot better. I think at the time I just said, yeah, I'm going to be my best self, into putting a ceiling on myself of, yeah, I know my stuff's not that great, but I'm going to make it. I'm going to command every single pitch that I throw and put it on, you know, dot a gnat's ass every single time. Instead of saying, I'll kind of show you, even that competitive aspect that I talked about, I'll show you and I'll break through that mold that you're talking about. I don't think I really knew how to do that. And so I didn't kind of, break that glass ceiling.
So do you think to, to be successful in pro ball, do you think a guy needs some of that, at least some like some increased, maybe oversized belief in themselves? Like, I think on the like on the opposite side of that, it's probably not healthy for a guy to think I'm a future Hall of Famer when, you know, that's you know, you're setting yourself up for a letdown in some ways. But do you think you need some sort of kind of bravado or exceeded confidence to be able to reach what is truly your ceiling?
I truly believe that. I mean, I think that phrase of fake it till you make it is in a lot of aspects true. I also think that doing well, success obviously breeds confidence, and, you know, confidence, you know, breeds that, like, that self-belief. And that's ultimately what you want to have, is that self-belief. And I think a lot of that also comes into self-evaluation. I think I was able to evaluate myself well at the time, yet I didn't know how to now push through that evaluation, how to get it better. I was okay with it because I was having success. And instead of saying, like, even jumping into the big leagues after having a pretty good freshman campaign in the big leagues first year, you know, minus a rough September, I think it was like, okay, you know, it'll just happen again. Instead of trying to stay ahead of the curve and trying to improve on different things, I always worked hard, but I didn't know what I was trying to improve on, I guess, is the point. And so that constant self-evaluation with also at least appearing to have that confidence, because especially as a pitcher, the minute you can see the shoulders slouch, the minute you see, woe is me, I mean, those hitters smell that blood in the water as those sharks, and they can feed off that, and they're just fighting to get up to the back rack, eventually into the box against you. And I've been on both sides of it. You know, I've been on the side of, man, you can't hit anything I throw, and it's a great feeling. And I've been on the side of, how the heck are you going to get yourself out, because I have nothing to get you out. And a lot of that goes into confidence and self-belief in those moments, and kind of how you get yourself in and out of it. And that's why they always talk about the mental side of the game. But there's a lot of tools out there now, from a performance standpoint to obviously sports performance, you know, like mental aspect coaches, that really help. And I think all the stuff that we have now are great things, you know, for the players and what they can use on their way up too.
So that you sign, you get a handful of innings and, you know, an A ball, you know, finish out in high A, but that first full year, they send you out, they jump you to high A. It's a tale of two halves. You cut your ERA by almost a run and a half in your first full season between first half, second half. What made the difference in that year? Was it a big adjustment? Was it just feeling out the league a little bit, learning about pro ball? Kind of what went, you know, how did you gradually get better in that season?
Well, it kind of played off a little bit of that first season of being drafted. And they sent me for a few weeks to Yakima, which didn't give up a run, pitching and relief. They actually asked me when I was drafted, do you want to start and go 1 to 2 innings every single time, no questions asked, or do you want to have some fun and maybe relieve, which will be a starter next year anyways? I said, let me relieve, let me close, that'd be fun. You know, just kind of like would give me some high leverage innings eventually. And they let me do that. So I relieved the whole time. I think I went to Yakima for a few weeks. I went to South Bend for like 2 days, pitched 2 innings there. And then they jumped me into up to Visalia and eventually into the playoffs with the Visalia team and some older guys. And I think I threw, I don't know, it was 18 innings or something like that year without giving up a run. And I was like, this thing is easy. You know, I'm fastball slider guys. I drop in a curveball every once in a while. Didn't really need to pitch and go through a lineup 2, 3, 4 times. And they first time seeing me, and I can dot on corners and guys, I can expose them, you know, swinging out of the zone as you know, I faced high enough competition through college that these guys weren't any better. And so going back into high the next year, kind of a little false confidence of now I got to go through the lineup 2, 3, 4 times potentially as a starter. And right at the beginning, my first month, I got shellacked. And I remember kind of thinking I could lay over that first pitch fastball. You know, as a starter, I'm just going to kind of cruise through these first 3 innings and then I'll give my stuff. And it was like, if I didn't dot a gnat's ass, I left it over the middle. These guys were swinging and swinging early. Once they realized that through strikes, they were coming out of their shoes. And until I learned how to kind of pitch backwards. And a big big thing for me was going inside on 0-1 fastballs and not being afraid to kind of miss, because the worst thing it could do would be 1-1. And that was a mentality kind of taught with me through the Diamondbacks is 1-1. I still had probably three and a half pitches I could throw for a strike against you. So establish that inner part of the plate, brush guys back.
How did you figure that out? Like how did you figure out specifically it was inside fastballs? Not, is that just a, you know, a trial and error thing? Is it someone, you know, had to tell you? How do you figure out that this is the area that I'm not doing as well as I need to be?
I figured out quickly. I didn't have as much off the plate to throw like I did in college.
Didn't have those 4 to 8 inches.
Yeah. And I was also, I had enough aptitude kind of to see that if you're lasering the ball as a righty in the right center gap and these guys are taking me off all day long, I'm probably not using both sides of the plate well enough. Pitching coach there, Willington Cepeda, who's with the Marlins now, I think as their bullpen coach, with Stoudemire, who was our pitching coordinator at the time. They're both over there. They kind of helped me with the count to go in. You know, I knew I had to go in, but if you think about like throwing inside, maybe 0-0, you're trying to maybe throw a strike and might bring it over the plate too much. So you kind of maybe guide it. If you throw it in there 1-0, you're probably trying to do the same thing. Guys are a little bit more trying to just maybe spin and take a gangster hack in those 1-0, 2-0, 2-1, 3-1 counts. And so you kind of get into this, okay, what does 0-1 do for you? If you can pick a pitch to get ahead, and usually with me, I drop in a curveball or slider, pitch backwards against these guys, because then they would usually take those pitches instead of coming out of their shoes off the fastball. Grab 0-1, and all of a sudden it's like, if I miss inside, it doesn't really matter because I'm 1-1. I can still come back with 3 or 4 pitches to throw a strike for you. So I knew I had to go inside. I just didn't know what count, probably. That was where my learning process was. And honestly, it kind of frees you up to be able to, if you have that mentality of, I don't care if I miss, I'm going to be aggressive in here. A lot of times you end up dotting that corner because you have that freedom of mind to do so. And so a lot of those times, if a kid is working on a pitch, even through the minor leagues, that's that count that obviously we kind of use that pitch in lower leverage situations to be able to kind of develop that belief in it. And then at any point when you kind of get in that flow, it can turn into any count at any situation in the game. If you'd be able to either throw that changeup maybe for a guy, or for me, it was the inside fastball to command both sides of the plate, because having command was something that was obviously a huge advantage for me. Yet if I just kind of went middle away with all pitches and cut one half of the plate, I'm not using it to my advantage. And so that was a huge thing for me to kind of flip those two halves that season.
Well, you get that figured out. You start using both sides of the plate. You jump to Double A next year. You have a quality Double A season, 3.98 ERA. The next year, you're sent back to Mobile, sent back to Double A. What is the mindset in repeating a level where you certainly didn't dominate it? Like you, and then you obviously respond well when you went back. But headed into your second season in Double A, what was on your mind? What was the goal there? Is there frustration with that, or is there unfinished business? How did you approach it?
You know, I think that, to be honest, being drafted in the second round, looking back now, because I'd always had this like ascending type thing. I always was going up through college. You get better every year. You're always having success a little bit more every year. Through the minor leagues, it was like, obviously I did well at levels, yet I didn't absolutely dominate them the whole time. And you have that false sense of like, that self-valuation I'm talking about at times. And I wouldn't call it entitlement for me, but some may as well as like, why am I going back here? Cause I was an all-star that year. If you look back, a 4 ERA, Double A, the Mobile is not that great. You know, it's okay. It's a pitcher's league. And for me, I found out I could really expose guys with like kind of first pitch, just getting ahead, because people had a much different mentality than they did in high A, where they just gangster acted everything. They actually had an approach. So I was able to get ahead of guys very, very early. So going back into that season, I was actually, before I realized all this and realized, honestly, that Reno is kind of the death for a pitcher, and I was lucky to go back to Mobile, and there's a reason for it. I was upset about it. I was never someone that went and told anyone that. It kind of just drove me, so it was a good thing. But I remember going back there. Once I'm in a position or anywhere that I go, I dive full in and give kind of everything I got. But I remember going into that season, like, why am I going back here? I was in big league camp again. Why am I doing this in my head? And going into that season, actually, my first month wasn't that great. I think it was a 3 ERA. You know, after repeating a level, I'm 23-ish or just turning 24 at the time. And I remember my boss now, like I had mentioned, Dan Carlson, came up to me and said, I just have a question for you. And we have a very close relationship now. We ended up having a very close relationship through that year. And so whatever he kind of said hit home. And he just said, why do you want to just be good? Why don't you want to be great? And kind of just left it at that, let kind of like ticking time bomb kind of sink in, knew how I ticked, knew what kind of drove me, knew I'd be super competitive through it. And, you know, let that kind of just, I guess, sink in. And I think the next month or 35 innings, something like that, struck out 50, walked one or two in my way to obviously getting that call to the big leagues.
How does that happen, though? Like, how? What is the difference between being good and being great?
He pushed me out of my comfort zone. The mechanical thing for me, which was played off of that mentality, was he knew that I was uber competitive. He knew I was probably, in some extent, just going through the motions without knowing I was going through the motions. It was an extra challenge. Like I said, a little ticking time bomb in there that he was able to kind of just let it sink in and let he knew it would absolutely drive me. Attention to detail, attention to what the leadership and the being the guy on that mound that everyone wanted to play behind every single day. And I think that going into you know, those next few months, like the mechanical thing, like I was saying, was he pushed me to get out of my comfort zone, so not to be a vanilla. That was the first year, actually. My velocity started like jumping 93s, 94s, and he wanted me to feel out of control. He said, I want you to be as out of control as you can feel, knowing that I would never walk people and still never be out of control. And I almost felt like I got faster down the mound. I got into great power positions, and it created an ultra-aggressive mentality that I was always on top of a hitter. That was always coming at you. Whatever pitch I threw, I wasn't throwing at 80%. I was coming at you 100% with a kind of bulldog mentality. And going back to, like I said, he just knew how I ticked and sparked that competitiveness drive in me to, I think, just pay attention to all things and not go through the motions.
Once things start clicking, did you have any indication that you were going to get jumped from Double A to the big leagues?
I didn't actually. Funny about that talk was Matt Tora and Wes Roemer had just actually gone up in the last few weeks to AAA. I was like, you know, they, I have a plan for everything. You never see this until you're on the coaching side. But I remember being upset about that in my mind and thinking, like, well, what's going on here? And so when they called me in, I was thinking, they're sending me to AAA, and I'm actually not super happy about it in my mind. And, like, again, I, for better or for worse, I'd never be someone that actually went out and said that. I always kind of went with it, absorbed it, let it drive me, et cetera. But DC, Dan Carlson brought me in, Rico Bronia, Turner Ward, and DC just said it and said, it's the call that you want, not the one that you think you're getting. And I kind of let that absorb for a second. And he said, your next start's going to be, you know, in St. Louis against the Cardinals. And I was like, what? You know, it kind of let this sink. We had a few tears together. Special moment. But never in my wildest dreams, actually, at that point. In AAA, you're always like, who's the next guy? Who's the next guy? But never in my dreams there did I think that I was – for some reason skipping AAA and heading to the big leagues, and it was a pretty special moment. The worst part was that they actually told me that I couldn't tell anyone until after the game, and you know, you're leaving tomorrow, but you can't tell anyone because they haven't announced anything yet. And so I had to sit there the whole game behind and do the chart while not telling anyone, even my family, until the game ended.
So how long from when you get the call to how long until you actually have to start taking the game, the big league game, seriously? Like, okay, I got to start figuring out how I'm going to get the Cardinals out. I have to, you know, actually, like, once you get through, I've got to tell all my family and I've got to get to Arizona and I've got to, you know, do all the stuff that comes with that call up. When do you actually get to focus on, okay, I actually have to play a baseball game against the St. Louis Cardinals?
You know, the craziest part about getting that call and in that moment was I had just thrown a game against Mississippi, the Mississippi Braves. It was a day game after getting rained out the day before. And I had gone through a streak like no other. I mean, like I said, that it was just a great month and a half of pitching. And I went into that game and felt like a little sluggish. I had warmed up about 20 pitches the day before it got rain, got shut down. They had debated not letting me start the next day. I can see now they probably were trying to keep me on that, you know, schedule to then be able to pitch in the big leagues the following one. And for, I think I hit two batters in the second inning, which I think I hit three batters all year on a usual. I wish I hit more, honestly. Would have created a little more intimidation probably. But I hit two batters in that game. I was all over the place. The second inning, I gave up one run on like 27 pitches, and I think I threw like 17 sliders to get out of it. My fastball command was going up by people's chins. My arm felt like it was late and way behind me. My body was rushing like no other that day, and I just couldn't feel it. And it was the first time in my life, that Y word, like I never felt it again ever in my life, that I felt like, can I throw a fastball over the plate? And I, like I said, I had to throw 17 sliders to get out of the inning. And ironically, I'm batting the next inning. Mike Minor's pitching. He throws the first one at my head. And I barked back at him, you know, if you're going to hit me, hit me. I remember hitting a line shot to shortstop and getting caught, and I was pissed because I didn't get on base. And I went back in on the dugout and I slugged a Red Bull and I came back out, and it was like you dotted a gnat's ass every single pitch. That feeling never came back. And went through five more innings that day, kind of dotting everything going where you want to, throw a great game, and you know, get that call 2 days later. And ironically, that feeling comes back, like, what if I start walking people again? What if I don't have that command? What if I get that feeling out there again? So to the point of trying to prepare for the Cardinals and stuff, honestly, I didn't have any knowledge of how to do so. Didn't have any knowledge of going through video or how to do that on a big league level. You're just show up to St. Louis. I was pitching a 12:30 day game. I think it was 105 degrees outside. And I know I'm stepping on a big league mound for the first time. And honestly, it was a surreal feeling. My legs, I never felt like I had my legs beneath me. I remember striking out like one of the first two batters or whatever. And I was like, this is easy. And Pujols came up in the first ball I threw over and you know, tried to steal a strike. And he lasered it foul for a homer. And I was like, okay, well, he doesn't think a fastball is coming again. I threw it middle away again. He lasered it over shortstop. And I went 2-0 to Matt Holliday and threw him a changeup, which I don't even know how I or why I threw because it's my fourth best pitch. He hit a double in the gap and scored a run. And I was like, okay, woof. Now you gave up your first run in the big league, settled down. Somehow I was able to get my legs under me and went shut out for the rest of that game. But to the scouting report part of it, I had a great catcher, Chris Snyder. You know, a lot of people probably didn't view him as the greatest catcher. I thought he was the best dude and absorbed me in and reeled me in from day one because I was in the fifth inning, guy second and third, and Matt Holliday up again. And I knew that he didn't know me that well other than catching me in big league camp. And I had a 1-2 count, and he called a curveball, and I shook, and he ran out to me. And instead of kind of bullying me or being a, you know, a, this is what you're going to throw or whatever, he asked me, what's your out pitch? And I said, it's my slider. And he said, we could throw that. But he's a great low ball side-to-side hitter. He really struggles with depth and a speed change. your curveball is good enough, put it on the plate, we'll strike him out. We'll do whatever you want, but I'm telling you, curveball is good enough, just put it on the tip of the plate. And he kind of instilled that confidence in me, threw it right where that was. Luckily, swung right out of the top of it, got out of the inning. That was the end of the debut. I thought it was really cool that he came out to me. He didn't just shake his head, basically like put another finger down, let me get whacked in the gap and spoil it. He was a competitor on the field, and this guy's a rookie, and we're gonna go through this together. And so he was basically my scouting report, is he knew the team to guide me through that game.
So this is a dumb question, but hear me out. How much harder is the big, or like, is pitching in the big leagues? Like, mm-hmm. It's an obvious question, but what is the hardest part of that? Just obviously hitters are better, the best hitters in the world. But how does that manifest itself in what you're trying to do up there in your personal game plan versus what you were doing in double A? Is there stuff that like takes away or stuff that you noticed right away? Like, because I mean, you turn in a quality season in your big league debut, but is there stuff that you notice like off the bat, like this isn't working as well?
You know, when I felt strong through that whole year, I was really flowing well from the double A, being with Dan. And I remember, I think it was a time in July that Stoudemire Jr. had come up to me and said, "Hey, we need to cut that long toss down a little bit. You're going to throw close to 200 innings this year." And I said, yeah, of course, blah, 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 blah. And I was just thinking, like, I got like a 190 ERA right now. Why the hell am I changing anything in my mind? So I kept going and kept going, kept going. And I had it could be a false sense of confidence, false sense of belief. I was rolling somewhat well, along with, I think it helped at the time of we didn't have a great team. You don't have a lot of media attention. It's your first time going up there. You don't have a huge lot of expectations, even though I like to say those things drove me being in the bigger moment. I think it took a lot of pressure off that first season as well. And I had never really gone through like kind of adversity yet. You know, I'd gone through it in spurts in the minor leagues, but through college, through ascending through the minor leagues to having a great start to a big league, kind of campaign, I think I never really had to deal with adversity. And so September hit, I no longer like felt great, kind of to that long toss thing and telling you need to take a little break. Again, I felt like my body was exhausted. My arm was behind me, and I think I gave up 16 home runs or something in September. And it went from commanding everything to everything over the middle of the plate, feeling like I'm throwing puff balls up there, and your confidence gets shook pretty good. And you realize, obviously, that mistakes get hit. And the more tentative you are, there's a difference between, even if it's only 92, there's a difference between 92 with conviction behind it, even if you miss your spot, 292 that you're just trying to guide up there. And a lot of times I thought that I dotted Nat's ass in these games that I did well. And I go back and look at film and I realized that I was just throwing it with conviction. I would miss up over the middle of the plate and people would swing through it at times. Because there's a little extra life at the end of the ball when you have that confidence. And so, you know, I was taught that, you know, even through Dan Heron and Zach Greinke at times, that you go look through film on what hitters do bad. A lot of times we go through film and see like, oh, they're batting 400. Prince Fielder's batting 400 on sliders, and go watch all the home runs he's hit. We'll go out, watch all, just like kind of watching BP, watch all the outs they make on pitches that are kind of missed right down the middle. Kind of ends up instilling that confidence in you and seeing in areas that obviously you can expose them, but also how we give them a little bit too much credit, I guess. But through that first year was tough because that was the first time ever dealing with adversity and not feeling my best. It wasn't until Stoudemire Jr. Came back and said, "Hey, you're not throwing a bullpen this week." So I always thought more was more. I never knew the less is more, type aspect. I was pushed through it, lifted harder, threw more bullpen pitches. And he finally said, "Hey, you're cutting it out. You're going to play catch with me this week. You're not throwing a bullpen. You're going to throw a flat ground with me, and you're going to jump back up there." And that was my only really good start in September, was when I threw 8 innings and gave up 2 runs. Ironically, lost to Kershaw and the Dodgers. But came back, and everything kind of came back that start.
It's tough to beat that Kershaw guy sometimes.
It was. I went through actually a decent streak of starting pitchers, and I think it was Lincecum 3 or 4 times, late toast when he was really good, or throwing gas. I had Ubaldo Jimenez twice. I had Strasburg. I had Kershaw. First hit was off Ari Dickey, knuckleball, when he's with the Mets. I went through, I don't know how I got on the number one starter train, because obviously I was not the number one starter.
It was like you were the Friday night guy.
Exactly. I got on that train of all these guys that threw. Lincecum wasn't Lincecum at the time. He was about the 90-94, but all these guys from Strasburg, Ubaldo, they're just pumping 99s and 100s at me. And it was a pretty special run to be able to pitch against them and hit against them. It was pretty cool.
Who'd you hit your dinger off in 2011?
Julius Chachin. Try to sneak 89.
That's a good one.
He tried to sneak 89, 2-1 pitch inside. Wasn't too smart. We joked about it when we were both with San Diego in 2017.
Good on you. That's a good one to get. But as far as
sadly, 2011, I got sent down the next day though.
That's tough. That's a tough beat. Yep. Tough scene there.
Yep.
But as far as 2011, you know, how did you envision 2011 turning out versus, you know, how it turned out? What was the big difference there with the comparison between, you know, you have this great AA season and then a quality big league debut, and then 2011 is, and you know, and 2012 too is a up and down between AAA and the big leagues, mostly AAA, and you know, kind of a tough scene in both Reno and Arizona.
You know, it was awesome going into, I mean, we'd switch from Josh Burns to Kevin Towers, and Kevin Towers came in the last month in September, and was the only time he saw me, obviously, when in pitching poorly. Going into spring training in 2011, I was actually really close with Kurt Gibson, and I think he just kind of liked some of like my mentality, and we grew our kind of relationship through that. And he came up to me and said, "Hey, it's your job to lose," because we brought in like Armando Galarraga, we brought in Zach Duke, we brought in guys that like it looked like, man, these are your established guys. Like, where do I fit into this 5-man rotation? Because we had Joe Saunders and Ian Kennedy and Daniel Hudson, and I remember him coming up to me, and if he didn't do this, it probably would have worked out a little bit different at the beginning. But he came up to me and said, "Hey, Barry, this is yours to lose. You know, this is your fourth or fifth spot." And created the confidence in there. I went into spring training and really just wanted to compete, and kind of came in there with a very hardworking, like kind of focused mentality, and said, "This is going to be my job and I'm not letting it go." And not everyone actually kind of knows about this, but with about, I think, 2.5 weeks to go in camp, like a 1-5 year, it was the best spring training I ever had. And Gibby brought me into his office. I said, I just went with, you know, you made the team. You're going to be in the 3 or 4 spot. You made the team. We can't tell anyone yet because we still haven't decided on a few guys who are going to be in those other spots. And I don't want to deal with the media hoopla right now, but I just want to let you know you earned this. Hell of a spring training. You're leading our staff right now, and you'll be in the 3 or 4 spot. You made this team. And so I leave that meeting, and I knew that I would still go through every one of my starts and have immediate questions of saying, "Hey, you're the only one with options left. You'll probably be sent down. How do you feel about that?" And I had to kind of play coy and just kind of give them the answers that kind of sounded right. I remember with about a week to go, about a week and a half after Gibby had already told me a week to go, and Zach Duke gets a line drive off his throwing hand and breaks his hand. And there were your 5 starters right there, because Zach was no longer in contention. And they basically had said every conversation after that, "Well, like, how do you feel now that Zach did this? You know, you're probably on the team," and every... The whole reason to everyone in the media, I had never, ever let this bother me before, was I made the team because this had happened. And I couldn't come out and actually tell them that Gibby told me I earned this before. I felt like I actually slided for the first time and I couldn't defend myself and because I didn't want to sell out my manager. And that was actually a tough time. And the first time I felt like I let everything else out of my control bother me. And so I went into my last two starts against, I think it was the A's and the White Sox in spring training. I got absolutely shellacked, gave like three or four homers. And my last start out before season started against the White Sox at Glendale, and went into that season on like a, almost like a downturn instead of flying high, which I was 2 weeks before. And going into my first start against the Cubs, you know, I pitched well on and off, but gave up four runs through six, got a no decision, and kind of flowed back and forth. And it was kind of like Zach Duke was possibly coming back here or there. That was starting to be mentioned. And instead of my focus being on just, hey, winning a ball game for my guys, it was now starting to defend myself or having to prove my worth so that I'm not the guy sent down. Listening to what the media is saying, you know, do you feel the pressure for this? Do you feel pressure for that? And kind of diving into those conversations instead of focusing on everything that I can control. And so it was a time that I think I let things affect me that were out of my control and affect me on the baseball field. That to go along with, like I had mentioned, of not knowing the adjustments that I needed to make, possibly. Couple of those two things together, and it wasn't the start to the season, you know, that I kind of wanted.
You get dealt to the Angels in 2012 in the midseason. Is there any optimism being traded for? Like, is there some credence to the fresh start theory or fresh start mindset?
You know, it's a weird thing to be traded because you forget first off that someone else wants you. You just think about at the beginning, like someone doesn't want you and you're leaving your first team. You obviously think, oh, I got a fresh start. I can do this. I can do that. But then you realize you get over there and not everyone doesn't know you the same. You know, you don't have the same coach staff. Not everyone maybe has your back the same. So you go through all those different emotions. It was honestly great for me. I ended up throwing well with them and obviously getting called up at the end. I mean, Jerry DePoto was over there, who was with the Diamondbacks before. But it was just a weird feeling. I didn't know how to feel because you were leaving a team that like you had your boys and a team that the only team I knew at the time. But it was a time going to the Angels that I wish, that was my kind of one regret, I would say. I mean, other than going through how 2011 went, like that's just being youthful and not understanding how to handle situations and adversity at times. But going in with the Angels is, you know, I actually threw really well and very sparingly roll. Like I only was up there, I think, through September because Weaver was ailing a little bit, but also competing for a Cy Young. And I was kind of there as backup. So I mopped up every inning. I don't think I gave up a run until I pitched the last day of the year. And I gave up six runs in the last inning against the Mariners. And so kind of like that spring training in 2011, you know, flowing into the 2011 season, that was a horrible sour taste I left in the mouth that now I'm worried about, oh, how does Socha think or Butcher think, you know, going into the following season? Like, look at what I just left them looking at. So again, worrying about things that are kind of out of control. And going into 2013, I remember AAA pitching coach pulling me aside and kind of going through a mediocre start to spring training because they gave me every opportunity actually. And now that I saw it, to make that team, they pitched me and, you know, started me in a lot of the games at the beginning. But I always, again, we had Tommy Hansen and Joe Blanton and, you know, you had Weaver, CJ Wilson, Urban Santana. You just think these are your solidified guys instead of having that compete type mentality that I had to start the 2011 spring training. I obviously missed that as I was going through and going through that adversity that, again, I don't think I was prepared for enough because, like we had talked about through high school, through college, through everything, through the success, there was never that downturn of extended failure. And, you know, everyone had told you you're a bulldog. And the first time you kind of see failure, don't really know how to handle it. And so not the fight or flight mentality. I wouldn't say I went all the way to the flight because I didn't even know I was doing it. But it was kind of like I was just a content in being where I was going
to
be at.
Fair to say you were kind of burnt out?
I mean, a little bit. I feel like I'm mentally exhausted. I didn't know I was doing this, you know, because I was never one that verbally had excuses. I never one that came out and said, you know, poor me. I was just kind of like burnt out of always compete, and getting after it. And then when I wasn't shown the results, maybe, or I would go through adversity, I actually didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to like, pick it up and go again because I didn't have enough of it before. I think it's prepared me to be a great coach, to be honest. I think it's prepared me later in life to be a pretty darn good father and things like that and help out. But I don't think I caught on to it fast enough through my baseball career and made the adjustments quick enough. And so in 2013, even when I got sent up, I had my start right before. It wasn't great and didn't even know why I was being sent up. I was put in the bullpen where I would like throw once every 2 weeks and once every 10 days. And I think I threw like the 17th, 18th, and 19th inning against the A's when I gave up the walk off to Brandon Moss. And I always felt like I was the last guy on the team. And those are my regrets. Instead of saying, hey, be the best long reliever there is, because there's been a lot of people that have made a hell of a career doing so, or find your way back to the, you know, fifth, sixth star, however it was, living in the moment and being present in that moment always. I think I didn't know how to do that then. It was kind of like always looking over my shoulder to either be sent down or not knowing how to be prepare myself every single day to be a long reliever and get my touch and feels in, so I was always sharp. I think that maybe if there was someone that was able to either show me that, or I was a little bit better equipped in those areas at a younger age, I think I could have excelled there. I didn't have the mentality for it at that time. I was kind of going through just this weird mental state that I didn't even know I was in. And so those are the regrets kind of going back, is I wish I would have dove in and said, I'm going to be the best long reliever ever. Every time you give me the ball, I'm getting those guys out. And even though I thought I was doing that, you look back and you weren't.
Well, after that tough 2013, though, you start making winter ball in Latin America, winter ball in Mexico, a regular part of your career. And eventually you're also playing in the Mexican Summer League as well. What did playing in the Mexican League do for you in terms of just your mentality and your enjoyment of baseball over the course of those few years?
To put it simply, it brought it all back. It brought all the love back for baseball, took the business part out of it. Obviously, they treat you like a big leaguer over there, but that was hardly the point. It felt like a family again. They cared about winning, going back to that college aspect of winning every single game and the importance being in it. I didn't know how crazy winter ball, like executives and all these people actually were about like, hey, you don't do well, you're in, you're out, and all these things. I just enjoyed the setting so much and diving into the culture and the people that because of that atmosphere and that culture that I truly believe is really, really important in winning teams and winning clubhouses. That's what made it fun for me. I mean, we were first place all year long. We had great players. We went to game seven. We won game seven on our turf. Like I had said, that, you know, they storm the field. They lift you up like Rudy. You party all night. I remember partying with like our teammates and parade down the street till about 9 a.m. I had a 10:30 flight, walked on the flight back home in Phoenix, you know, by 11:30, and hadn't slept a wink. And it was such a cool thing to enjoy with people that really enjoyed it as well. From learning, like, obviously more in-depth Spanish and trying to do interviews in Spanish and guys really, really enjoying that from the team and kind of just treating you like another brother, really, really helped me enjoy, baseball down in Mexico and brought me back year after year after year.
What were the biggest differences kind of on the field? How is the game played differently in because like the Mexican Summer League, the Mexican Winter League are classified as AAA. How is the actual on-field product different? Does your style of pitching have to be different?
I learned very quickly there's two things you learned that foreign guys that come in are usually guys that are, you know, from especially the Hermosillos and the big market teams, are guys that are either big leaguers or, you know, that 4A type player that are going to big league camp. And you usually spin them to death. You know, they come down to try to hit homers off fastballs. And you learn that part of it. And then the older Mexican hitter, because Mexican players throw so many breaking balls, they're such good breaking ball hitters and they have slower bats, that you pound them inside over and over and over and over. And once I learned the kind of the trend of those two aspects of like the two different hitters, I kind of fit the mold. Honestly, no one really changed off of that. I also think that there's a high quality of player in the winter league. I do think summer, for the most part, actually has a pretty quality close to AAA. I wouldn't say that. I would say some teams, like the Tijuana teams that were on, were definitely AAA teams. They're just a little bit older. I mean, when I got there, it was me, Inesky Betancourt, Jose Contreras, Miguel Olivo. You know, like these guys are all salty veterans, and they're obviously a little bit out of, you know, past their prime.
Those dudes broke into the big leagues when I was in like elementary school.
It was phenomenal. It was awesome. And, you know, we had that team. Then the next year we had, you know, Hector Ambriz, Alex Nabia, Horacio Ramirez, myself, Betancourt again, Miguel Olivo, Juan Apodaca. Like we, there's a few more too. Alex Romero, guys that have played in the big leagues, some for a few years, and they're kind of just all in that 30-year-old range that when they started to filter that 29, 30-year-old out of baseball.
For any listeners that haven't, like, Mexican Winter League TV is a great buy because it is like a, oh, hey, that guy, paradise.
Yeah. Yep. And I would say, like, as a whole, the league's a little bit better in winter because there's teams in summer that just don't, you know, there's more teams and they just don't get the same parity that there's. I mean, Tijuana, we were so much better than other teams other than maybe Mexico City and Monterrey and some of the big market teams. But winter baseball was awesome. And the quality of baseball was really, really good. Sometimes, honestly, the best teams down in winter baseball were actually filled with a lot of, like, independent league guys. And that's the only reason that was good for them is not only because there's really good guys actually independent ball at times, but those guys would stay all year round and they're kind of playing for their livelihood and for that next season every single year. Some of the guys that would come down to the bigger market teams at times knew they were going to big league camp, knew they were going to be just fine, knew they were where they're going to be, and kind of just went down to get at bats and get in and get out. And so they didn't always actually have as much success as they probably could have. You know, they didn't dive into the league as much, but there's a quality of baseball down in Mexico that I would say the big difference is I thought that there'd be a lot of like base running, base stealing. I don't know why I thought that down in Mexico. I love that no one stole bases. Only foreign players stole foreign people or foreign imports stole bases. And so anytime you got like a guy, a native player on base, they never stole.
Those old guys aren't trying to run.
They're not trying to run at all. I didn't realize, I think, my first year that they're all like 38, 36. You know, I didn't realize there's a lot of, you know, a lot of veteran players throughout the league. And so there wasn't a lot of base stealing, which just takes that aspect of baseball out a little bit and lets you calm down, just kind of focus on the hitter.
So you get a few years in Mexico in, you hop back into affiliated for a few stints, and then 2018, you wrap it up. What kind of sealed it for you is it was time to hang up the spikes, but then get into coaching.
I had been traded from Tijuana to Cancun, in 2018 and
call that one the vacation swap.
It was, I wish it could have been that. But Fernando Valenzuela, senior and junior were our owners and president of the team. And they kind of brought me over there. We had lost in the championship that year. We had two seasons in one for that year. So they went to a soccer style format, and there's playoffs through June and like a championship in the middle of June. And then you'd start a week later, you'd start a new season, kind of like how they do in the soccer down there. And Through the first year, you know, they expect you when they pay you as a foreign player that if you're getting paid the highest on the team or up there that you're going to be throwing all the time. And so I went and I threw game one and game five of the championship series. And then we had a day off and there was game six. I had told them before the season that, hey, on June 16th, my brother is getting married and I'm in his wedding. I'm telling you now, just in case there's conflict, et cetera. I had written my contract, the whole shebang. That time comes up. It just so happens it's the World Series, you know, of the season. And I pitched game one, game five. I flew back the next morning, went to the wedding for game six. We have been up 3-2. We lost game six. And so they said, hey, we need you back. And so I had pitched, obviously, 2 days before. I threw, I think it was like 108 pitches, through 8 1/3 when we won. And they flew me back. I was in Tahoe, Lake Tahoe. I went an hour drive from Lake Tahoe to Reno at 3:30 in the morning. I had a 5:30 flight. Went flight from Reno to LAX, LAX to Mexico City, Mexico City to Yucatan. Got into Yucatan at 7:45. The game was at 8:05. I got to the field at about 8:10. Game had already started. They gave me a little shot of B12 and Voltaren. They rubbed my arm down, and I was in there by the bottom of the second with the bases loaded, two outs. I threw 5 1/3. We were up going into the ninth. We're up 3-2, and our closer gave up a run, made 3-3. We lost in the bottom of the 14th, and season was over through there. I had thrown two more games a week later when the season started again, and Mike Bell had actually called and asked me to, knew I was there. I'd always kept in touch with Dan Carlson, who's pitching coordinator, like I'd mentioned. And Mike and DC had called and said, hey, would you be willing to come back? We need a spot in AAA. And it was just getting, I think, hard family-wise at that time. I was no longer living with my family in San Diego and just crossing the border every day in Tijuana. I was a five-hour flight away with two kids at home. And I was healthy. I was still able to pitch. I don't know if it was the caliber to pitch in the big leagues again, but it was still, you know, I think I got worn down from all the innings. You know, that was the good and bad of going, you know, to Mexico all the time, is I think I threw 252 innings in one season, but and played two Caribbean series, but the experiences are, you know, priceless. And so I think with the wear and tear, with along with the family being at home, it was an easy time just to kind of obviously come back to the States, come back, take the opportunity of the Diamondbacks, and then eventually in talking with Mike and Dan Carlson, that was where they were trying to shift me, is basically seeing me as a coach, and brought me back to basically ask me that, let me play out my last time in the States. They were awesome to me through the end of it, even when they, like, roster spots were, you know, like, I guess ended up getting filled. They put me on the Phantom at the time. They were still great with me and my family, and basically said, we brought you back because we think you're going to be an awesome coach, and kind of transitioned in me, gave it, put it on my plate to kind of digest my family. And we just kind of saw it as a life full circle, kind of God's work, bringing us back to the Diamondbacks, and, you know, start of where, obviously career began, and with the same great people that were actually my coaches coming up, the opportunity was just kind of too tough to pass up.
So, you know, heading into 2021, I mean, hopefully things go smoothly as far as baseball. We got some, the day we're recording, got some great vaccine news. So, you know, hopefully you're out there, you know, coaching someone this year, doing for some sure work. But to take it kind of full circle, what do you, you know, if you could have a conversation with, you know, 21-year-old Barry getting out of Pepperdine right before you sign, what would you, you know, sit that guy down and tell him? And kind of what do you tell your, you know, what do you tell your recent college and high school signees about life in the minor leagues?
You know, I think the part of learning the aspect of like being cultured, don't be scared to kind of dive in and experiment, not only on the baseball side, but to enjoy the aspect of all guys around you. to enjoy all the new things that kind of come your way. Don't let them discourage you. Don't let them, kind of beat you down. More so kind of take that time in. And like I talked about through Mexico and those things, that culture aspect of it really brought enjoyment to me. And, you know, on the baseball side of things, I think I tell them when teams do well, individuals do well. And we try to create as good an atmosphere and culture that we can in any given moment, and kind of choose things to bring those guys together. I think when they choose to enjoy their teammates and not just the individual aspect of it, I really think that guys end up doing really, really well throughout their seasons as well.
Barry, I've got a quick rapid fire for you, and then I'll let you get out of here.
All righty.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
Reno, actually, even though I hated pitching there.
Tough spot to pitch. Great ballpark, though. Right across the street from that casino. It's wonderful. Yep. Favorite big league ballpark?
AT&T. Is it still AT&T? Giants?
I think. Or is it Oracle now, or is that the Warriors? I can't remember.
That's the Warriors. AT&T, awesome. Sneaky second is PNC. Pittsburgh is really, really cool backdrop at the bridge. PNC is awesome as well.
They're both on my bucket list. Best hitter you ever faced?
I would probably have to say Albert Pujols.
Best pitcher you ever faced?
Clayton Kershaw.
Best food spot in Major League Baseball or Minor League Baseball?
Cincinnati, maybe Clubhouse with what are the darn sandwiches in Cincinnati? It's a tough one.
The chili whatever it Cincinnati, is, I would like to try it.
Yes, the chili in Cincinnati and the darn sandwiches in Cincinnati. I forget what they're called. But Cincinnati Clubhouse, they're really, really good, which is crazy to say over all the steakhouses you possibly mentioned throughout the way.
Yeah. Best food you ate in Mexico?
The street tacos right next to our hotel called Taco Haas. Amazing.
Sounds fantastic. Last one. If you could tee it up at one PGA event that isn't the Masters, what's your pick? Because the Masters is too easy. Waste Management,
Phoenix Open.
Have you played the – because you live in Arizona. Have you played the course?
Many a times. Best round there is a 63. But I caddied for my financial advisor once with Kevin Na in our group, and he had talked to me about actually baseball and the 16th hole and how they kind of go towards each other, like and pitching in front of 50,000 people, and how would you do that? You know, it makes me nervous to step inside the arena, the 16th hole. And I always told him, so the craziest thing is pitching in Giant Stadium at 12:30 in the afternoon, you get 50,000 people at AT&T Park, and everyone are hooting and hollering at you when the Giants were good, and it's all white noise. It's kind of Kevin Costner, clear the mechanism. When you got the Diamondback Stadium, when we weren't very good, and you got 5,000 people in there, and you got one guy yelling, "Hey, Barry, you suck," you hear that one guy. And so I told him, make it white noise. Walk into that 16th hole, pump the whole crowd up. Don't be the guy that step away from the ball. Make sure they're all on their feet and they're all making white noise for you. I promise you it'll all change. And so Kevin and I have kept in touch over the years, actually, and he does it every single time now. So now I think about it all the time. And now all I want to do, as I told him, is I want to beat him at that tournament. But I tried to qualify 2 years. I missed out by 3 strokes 1 year. And when I shot a 66 in the Monday qualifier, I missed out by 1 stroke 4 years ago. So,
oh, man. Well, I hope you get
in. We're getting close. We're getting close. That would be the tournament because I just love the atmosphere of all the fans.
You got to start walking in your putts like Kevin Na.
That is a very awesome thing to do. We've done all that. I think I've done the early walk too many times, though, when it lips out. So you got to make sure they're in. I think Kevin knows they're in a little bit more than what I know I'm in.
I that is probably safe to say. Barry Enright, thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, brother.
You got it. And that's it for our episode with Barry Enright. Huge thanks to Barry for taking the time. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Rate and leave a review if you're on Apple Podcast. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday, so stay tuned in 2 weeks for our next episode. And remember, it's always a great time to be subscribed to BaseballAmerica.com for all amateur, prospect, and college baseball news. Until then, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.